Hello, everyone, and welcome or welcome back to the latest episode of Sapphiccast. This episode is going to be a bit different from previous episodes in terms of both structure and content because it is for my final history project, but it details a lot of really important elements of lesbian history that I think are talked about nowhere near enough. So stick around and let's get into it. I'm going to start this episode off by reading a brief summary of what I'm going to be talking about, and then we'll get into our sources and our information. So for this final project, I am going to examine the role of Jewish women in the second wave feminist movement as their contributions, both those which massively furthered the movement and those which greatly limited it, are something which are consistently erased and left out of history. Betty Friedan's The Feminine Mystique is credited with, along with the Civil Rights Act of 1964, playing a major role in sparking the second wave feminist movement of the 1960s. Often left out of the conversation is how Friedan's societal position as a Jewish woman informed and fueled her activism, as well as made her susceptible to certain biases that are especially prevalent within the Jewish community. Friedan once said, "I remember my father telling me that I had a passion for justice. But I think it was really a passion against injustice, which originated from my feelings of the injustice of anti-Semitism, demonstrating participation in a long-standing Jewish tradition of social justice advocacy." However, later in her career, Friedan revealed reductive views on sexual politics, particularly lesbianism, painting them as divisive and unnecessary rather than acknowledging the unique struggle of existing at the intersection of misogyny, homophobia, and for Jewish lesbians, anti-Semitism. Perspectives like that of Betty Friedan are representative of one of the central problems of the second wave feminist movement. Organizing a diverse group of people with different backgrounds under an all-encompassing umbrella of womanhood was too broad a practice and failed to actually address the needs of all its members. Homophobia of this sort amongst feminists, as well as a heavily instituted patriarchy in the Jewish community, led to those who occupied multiple marginalized identities, such as Jewish lesbians, to feel extremely alienated by the movement. Although the movement lasted approximately 2 decades, over time, it became more and more divided. The exclusion of a great many people that should have benefited from the feminist movement are a great part of what caused this second wave to fracture. To make this podcast, I am using my own historical research, From Margin to Center by bell hooks and Nice Jewish Girls by Evelyn Thornton Beck, as a critical framework to analyze the ideas expressed by Betty Friedan's The Feminine Mystique. Joining us today as my conversational partner, guest, and another Jewish lesbian perspective is Nadia Stotter of the BMC Class of 2024. And it is really important that we're having this conversation because truly understanding the message of the feminine mystique is crucial to resisting liberal assimilationist feminism. So welcome, Nadia.
Thank you.
In order to fully understand Betty Friedan's perspective, we're going to have to look at her life and her background and the overall course of her career in addition to the feminine mystique, because we need to understand the life that she led and the experiences that she had that may have led her to internalize biases, to internalize a sense of assimilation to American culture in order to really get what she's saying with the feminine mystique and all of the nuances and all of the perspectives that she erases with it. So starting from when she was 17, there is a quote that says that she vowed to herself that if they don't like me, they're going to have to respect me. And this is in reference to white, Gentile, upper middle class women. So this is showing that she's entering her adult life immediately seeking the approval of this quote unquote high society America, this high society form of feminism, bourgeois feminism, basically. She's going into her life immediately seeking that approval. And this really goes to show a major problem throughout the second wave feminist movement as a whole, which is that there was a consistent centering of both whiteness and Christianity and the comfort of white people and Christian people throughout the second wave feminist movement, which obviously excluded a lot of people. And despite her Jewishness, or maybe because of her Jewishness, she ended up perpetuating this centering of whiteness and Christianity and upper class America. Having grown up distanced from Judaism as a religion and as a moral code and as a belief system and identifying with agnosticism or atheism, Betty Friedan prioritizes her identity as both a white woman, especially an upper class white woman, and as an American woman, over her identity as a Jew, and fails to critically analyze her identity as a Jew in the feminine mystique in any capacity. which is erasive of a whole bunch of experiences, not to mention the experiences of women of color, for one, which is a very big thing that bell hooks talks about and we're going to get into later. But the experience of other Jewish women, and many of whom were immigrants, were refugees, were workers in factories, and Betty's universalizing of her own experience is erasing the experience of other Jews as well. So what is clear going into the feminine mystique immediately is that she lacks a critical, or rather intersectional, in the words of Kimberly Crenshaw, an intersectional understanding of the role that ethnicity and race plays in designating societal positions, in designating who is considered American and who is considered non-American or an other or a foreigner. And also the ways that who is othered means that they have different needs that the feminist movement should have been addressing but wasn't addressing, because she universalized her own experience as an upper middle class white woman who is completely distanced from her Judaism at this point, it seems, because she isn't critically analyzing it in her activism at all, and erasing the experiences of just about everybody else. So ultimately, the feminine mystique functions as a critique of the role of white, middle to upper class, cisgender, and heterosexual, able-bodied American liberal women, but fails to critically examine how Friedan's Jewishness impacts her role in society, likely because of her personal assimilation. So we're going to go into a little more detail about what it means to assimilate to a capitalist white supremacist system, as somebody that is still oppressed under white supremacy, but also just what assimilation means in general, and how in a lot of cases it can mean a performance for white Christian society, and not only just erasing aspects of yourself, but also taking on a persona in order to try and impress, but also not seem too threatening to white Gentiles, essentially. And in Nice Jewish Girls, and there are a lot of personal essays by prominent Jewish feminists such as Adrienne Rich, and there's a very common theme of parents being distanced from Judaism due to trauma, and then their children in turn growing up disconnected from their heritage. And this, in the context of like America during World War II and all of that, this is basically like a scare tactic to scare Jews into silence and to keep them from passing on their Jewishness. So many Jews of Friedan's generation did grow up distanced from their heritage despite being Jewish or having Jewish parents or any of that, because their parents were just too afraid to really truly be their Jewish selves. Other aspects that can cause people that are Jewish to grow up disconnected from their Judaism are the patriarchal aspects of Jewish law that can keep many gender minorities that are Jewish disconnected from their own history, because so much of the history that we do get within Jewish spaces is completely patriarchal. And additionally, the education that Jews growing up in America receive is Christian in nature and assimilates Jews into a culture which is inherently Christian. So assimilation as a performance seems to look like white women having a frustration with not having the social capital of white men and wanting to be right up next to white men in terms of upholding white supremacy and all oppressive systems. But assimilation as a practice, in more of a subconscious way, I would think, is the very act of failing to address anti-Semitism in the feminist movement as a Jew. Failing to address this is itself a form of assimilation. And although assimilation is rooted in fear and generational trauma, it still reproduces systems of oppression. And when it comes to discussions around marginalization and oppression, impact always matters more than intent. There are many, many valuable parts of Nice Jewish Girls that are useful in critiquing Friedan's career as an activist and her writings, but a part that I found particularly poignant, especially in this case, is a chapter in which it discusses anti-Semitism in the feminist movement, specifically the lesbian feminist movement, but I think this can be applicable to the feminist movement as a whole. And it talks about disappointment with other Jewish women and other Jewish feminists failing to call out anti-Semitism in any capacity, despite it being extremely pervasive and making Jews feel very, very excluded. And there's a quote from this book that says, "I hope that by examining their own anti-Semitism, Jewish women will conclude that anti-Semitism, like any other ideology of oppression, must never be tolerated, must never be hushed up, must never be ignored, and that instead it must always be exposed and resisted." And then this passage is followed by a list of questions that it encourages both Jewish and non-Jewish women, as well as other people, to ask themselves in order to examine their own internal anti-Semitism and begin to unlearn that and apply that unlearning and then the process of learning a consciousness for Jewish liberation into their activism. And I mean, all I have to say is that I think Betty Friedan could have used this list. Another particularly notable example of Friedan perpetuating anti-Semitism within her work is in this quote from The Feminine Mystique, which reads, "The feminine mystique has succeeded in burying millions of American women alive. There is no way for these women to break out of their comfortable concentration camps except by finally putting forth an effort." The notion, the concept of a comfortable concentration camp is interesting, to say the least. It's problematic for many reasons. Notably, in my opinion, most notably, is that the use of concentration camps has historically always been racialized. It's always been a racial thing. And for the feminine mystique to just not address race at all, but then weaponize the idea of a concentration camp to illustrate like white women's oppression is just very, very strange. And it's honestly reminiscent of things like the modern Zionist movement weaponizing histories of concentration camps to propagate oppressive policies and settler colonialism. So it's just, it's a very liberal at best, more right-leaning at worst, I would say, take that is reeking of internalized anti-Semitism and just reproducing anti-Semitism itself. And I talked to you a bit about this, and you talked about your grandma, who was like the anti-Semitic Jew. So do you want to talk a little bit about her? And I think that this is an important conversation to have because when it comes to ideas of like Jews having internalized anti-Semitism and then reproducing it, it's very dangerous because it doesn't only make it so that other Jews internalize like self-hatred, but it makes it so that white Gentiles think it is acceptable to perpetuate Jew hatred. Mm-hmm. So one of the major weapons against Jews in history, but I think particularly in America as well, is just making them hate themselves so much that they just don't identify with Judaism. And that just leaves the Jewish community completely fractured. So yeah, go ahead and talk about her a bit.
So my grandmother had this wonderful combination of the fact that she was very self-hating. She was very much a self-hating Jew, but she was also dealing with a lot of internalized misogyny. Mm-hmm. So I think about when she first came to America, it was in the 1970s, so it's just, you know, second wave feminism, a lot of women trying to be taken as seriously as members of the workforce, and that when she came here, she saw women fighting for the right to have jobs and to be able to have lives outside of the home, and my grandmother, who had spent her entire life so far in the Soviet Union, was very put off by this because she had a job. She had never experienced not having the opportunity to have a job. She just wasn't able to get the job she wanted, not because she was a woman, but because she was Jewish. Her dream when she was a kid was to be a mathematician, but she wasn't allowed to go to the university she wanted to because on her passport it said Hebrew, and they had a certain quota. Well, actually, in Russian it's technically Yevrei, but that does directly translate to Hebrew. And so many of the universities had a Jewish quota, and so she couldn't go. So she became an engineer, which, while in America, engineering is a very, you know, a very respected job, in Russia, that was just, it wasn't held with the amount of esteem that we hold it to in America. So she was definitely very bitter about the way that she was treated as a Jew in Russia, and then coming to America and seeing the way that white feminists were complaining about American issues, she felt very excluded and felt kind of like, well, what about me? This has nothing to do with me. And in terms of Jews, you know, upon coming to America, she was, my family members, my grandparents and their kids, my mom and her brother, they were exiled from Russia, and they came to America and were welcomed by Hias and also other American Jews, and my grandmother just could not connect with them. Their life experiences were nothing like hers. They kept saying like, oh, finally, well, now you're in America and we can welcome you into, you know, religious ceremonies. You can come to temple with us. And my grandmother did not want to do that. She did not want to go to temple. She didn't come here because she was a refusenik, because of religious freedom. She came to America because she had no other choice. They were literally kicked out by Brezhnev, and they had nowhere else to go.
Yeah, so I think that there is a lot with that anecdote that can be applied to what we're talking about here in terms of the intersection between internalized anti-Semitism and internalized misogyny, and how those two play into each other, and seeing like white women feminists who are only addressing the needs of other white women feminists. And again, with Betty Friedan, who was Jewish but completely assimilated in this sense and really only served the needs of upper class white women, your grandmother was a Jewish woman who also had white skin. Betty Friedan's activism did nothing to serve your grandmother. So that's extremely notable here. And additionally, disconnect with the American Jewish community as well, and the xenophobia that comes with that, and the assimilation that is kind of felt by any American Jew because of the insane pressure to assimilate, as well as that's just kind of the culture of these communities until you take the time to consciously unlearn it. And I think that, oh, and additionally, that your family was exiled for being communists.
No? They were exiled. They were, so everyone, basically in the Soviet Union, everyone was a communist. And also, so something important to know, that in terms of Jews, many of the Jews who came here were what we refer to as refuseniks, meaning that they came here because they wanted to practice religion freely. The Jews who came here who weren't refuseniks were usually atheists. So that was my family. They came here not because they disagreed with communism. They came here because they disagreed with Soviet invasion of Czechoslovakia.
Mm-hmm.
And so my grandfather helped organize a protest at Red Square, basically combating Soviet invasion of Czechoslovakia and the human rights violations of Czechoslovakians. And they ended up being exiled to Siberia. He went with my grandmother and my grandmother's son. And my mom was actually born in Siberia. And eventually he was allowed back into Moscow, but then very quickly they said, actually, you know what? We really don't want you here. You need to leave. And so that is very much, there's a very common experience for a lot of Jewish immigrant groups in general, but from my experience being a Russian Jew, in that you're never Jewish enough for the American Jews, and you're too Russian for American Jews. But then for Russian Americans, you're not Russian enough because you're too Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
So in any, there's the experience of being a Soviet Jew is that you never really feel included in any kind of diaspora community.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's just so much, you either face xenophobia from American Jews or you face anti-Semitism from Russian Americans who are white Gentiles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and yeah, this is highlighting yet another group that Friedan, as an assimilated Jewish American woman, who really, I think, should have been addressing the needs of her entire community, the entire global Jewish community, she just did nothing.
Mm-hmm.
that would actually serve Russian Jewish immigrants, for example. So your family was exiled not just for being communist, because everyone was a communist, but for being communist and anti-imperialist.
Yes.
Okay. So again, this is another like global perspective that she's clearly lacking. And additionally, showcasing the mindset of more working class Jewish people, that by universalizing her experience as this upper middle class liberal, she is erasing a long radical Jewish history.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like, I know my mom, so when my family came to the US, my grandfather got a job teaching at a private school in Tarrytown, Westchester County, New York. And so my mom grew up being surrounded by a bunch of rich kids. And because it was New York, a lot of the rich people were Jewish. And so my mom had the experience of being surrounded by other Jews, but she never felt included because she was poor. She was an immigrant, and the Jews around her were richer, and they just didn't understand her experience at all. And so she began, I know my mom began associating Judaism just in general with wealth. Like, I remember when I first wanted to go to a Rosh Hashanah service when I was around 16, and I told my mom and said, oh, well, you know, do you want to come to this? And her immediate reaction was, well, it's probably too expensive. And she was really shocked when I said, no, actually, it's free. We don't have to pay. And she hadn't even considered that. She just immediately thought, oh, well, we're not going to be able to afford this anyway. That's just not even an option.
Mm-hmm. And honestly, the pervasive classism in the Jewish community is yet another example of the internalization of anti-Semitism, because Jews are so much scapegoated for the evils of capitalism and seen as like the filthy rich Jew. That means that the Jews that do get rich have a very severe internal classism and superiority complex, mm-hmm. because of the capital that they have accumulated. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times we'll have this mindset that doesn't really care about Jews that are further marginalized than they are. So really what we're seeing here is this equating of gender-based oppression to race or ethnicity-based oppression, when the material consequences of those things are so drastically different. And this functions as a whitewashing of both feminism and history. And another thing that we're seeing here is that Friedan is weaponizing anti-Semitism to promote a liberal assimilationist agenda that doesn't actually address the needs of all Jews. And this is just setting a very dangerous precedent. And I think we're seeing the consequences of that today with the Zionist movement. Again, mm-hmm. weaponizing anti-Semitism, specifically white Jews weaponizing anti-Semitism, in order to advance settler colonialism. And so it's really not surprising that Friedan later in her life, as she actually became conscious of her Judaism, became a Zionist,
right.
and began to advance Israelis instead of addressing the needs of working class Jews, factory working Jews, queer Jews, Jews of color. Mm-hmm. From Margin to Center by Bell Hooks is the response that Bell Hooks chose to write to Friedan's The Feminine Mystique, and it quite literally takes the voices and the perspectives of marginalized people and moves them to the center of the conversation and combats Friedan's universalizing of her own actually quite specific experience. Hook says that Friedan did not speak of the needs of women without men, without children, without homes. She ignored the existence of all non-white women and poor white women. Friedan's The Feminine Mystique addresses a specific higher class of women who are bored with their leisure and their material wealth, and in turn want to go into the workforce to accumulate more wealth and basically try and have the same power as white men. And what Bell Hooks is saying is that there are plenty of women who work because they have to and because they need money to survive, whereas these women are looking for like executive corporate jobs and just kind of general girl bossery, when Hooks is pointing out that there are plenty of women who need to work just to live. Additionally, Bell Hooks adds another important dimension to the conversation, which is addressing who the domestic work will fall to when wealthy white women try and enter the workforce. And usually that means women of color. So women of color end up having to take over the household duties of white women going into these jobs to just build more and more wealth and then usually hoard it. And this structure has its legacy in slavery. Overall, From Margin to Center by Bell Hooks takes the time to point out the many different women and many different people whose needs were not being addressed by the second wave feminist movement, and also points out that the women who were experiencing the so-called oppression of the feminine mystique, to experience the feminine mystique is in itself a privilege. And Bell Hooks really points this out throughout her critique. And the fact that this critique shows all the countless ways that Friedan's activism and her perspective doesn't actually address the needs of so many marginalized groups of women and so many different minorities is showing that Friedan is basically a personification of the model minority myth and is fulfilling the model minority myth by perpetuating this liberal assimilationist activism. So at this point, it is abundantly clear that Friedan's form of activism is exclusionary of many, many different types of women. But we're going to take a moment to zero in on a specific group of people that Friedan targeted, basically, and made an active effort to exclude from the second wave feminist movement, and that group is lesbians. Betty Friedan started the National Organization for Women, which abbreviates to NOW, and one of her top concerns was what male America and middle American women thought of this organization and thought of the aims of this movement. So she was basically trying to perform and pander to a very cis heteronormative crowd. And because of this, Friedan and other heterosexual feminists were very, very concerned with the presence of mannish or man-hating lesbians that would hinder the cause and they feared would derail the cause and interrupt the true aims of their organization in terms of both aesthetic and in terms of the actual policies that they were looking to put through. In 1969, Betty Friedan herself actually coined the phrase Lavender Menace, which led to a massive reclamation push among the lesbian feminist movement, who proudly were like, yeah, we're the Lavender Menace. And we're coming to quote unquote take over the feminist movement, when what it really meant is ask the feminist movement to address the needs of all the women it was supposed to protect. And another quote from Friedan is that homosexuality is not, in my opinion, what the women's movement is all about. And we already know at this point that Friedan is largely performing her activism for white Gentile society. And that becomes incredibly apparent here because she seems to be assimilating to a form of social Christianity and Christian ideas of who people should love and how they should present. But at the same time, she is bringing in extremely patriarchal biases that come from the Jewish community as well. Betty Friedan wrote that she warned against proselytizing for lesbianism because she feared that it would create a sexual red herring that would divide the movement and lead ultimately to sexual McCarthyism. Which is a very interesting choice of words. The proselytizing, for one thing, because Friedan, however assimilated, was Jewish, and Judaism is against proselytization. So that was definitely a very pointed comment showing her very pure disdain for the lesbian community. And to compare the lesbian community's aims in terms of sexual freedom to McCarthyism is so interesting because, I mean, I guess what she's saying is that men would be held accountable for things like assaults. And that is comparable to McCarthyism somehow. So there's some really severe internalized patriarchy at play here, which is clear. Because the thing is that homophobia is inherently misogynistic. And there,
anyone who is a homophobe is also a misogynist inherently, because it's all part of the same oppressive system of gender. And she seemed to think that treating lesbians as full humans that needed their needs addressed and needed equal rights would pose a major threat to heterosexual America.
I also find it very interesting to hear a Jewish woman pointing out things of being McCarthyism that are decidedly not McCarthyism, considering who many of the victims of McCarthyism were. And the Red Scare in general, even beyond McCarthy, was the amount of Jews who were actively targeted, like the Rosenbergs, for instance, the way that particularly Soviet Jews who were in America, but also American Jews, were seen as just, they were communists because communism was a foreign ideology. Jews were foreign. It was just yet another instance of Jews being perceived as the other. And so being the other, they have to represent the foreign, scary Eastern ideology.
Yeah, and the impacts of McCarthyism ended up gutting many of the leftist and communist and socialist Jewish organizations in America, which has a legacy even today of the majority of Jewish organizations in America that we know of being liberal or even right-wing. So ultimately, men were looking to discredit the feminist movement, and Betty Friedan was willing to sacrifice the interests of lesbians in order to be taken seriously by men. And this is one instance in a long list that is forming a pattern showing that Betty Friedan seems to have a limited understanding of Jewish oppression, which is limited by heteropatriarchy and liberalism, because she recognizes that Judaism has some patriarchal aspects, but doesn't seem to understand the full depth of how gender nonconformity is punished in the Jewish community. And she, in part, analyzes some controlling images of Jewish women and how Jewish mothers are portrayed as overbearing, but she misses out on the gendered implications of how Jewish women in media are either always portrayed as super hyper-feminized and fit to the male gaze, or super hyper-masculinized and meant to be mocked and laughed at. And obviously, her attitude on butch lesbians in particular directly connects to this. So later in her career in 1977, Betty Friedan essentially performatively pledged her allegiance to lesbians and publicly stated that she would look out for lesbian interests in her activism. But at that point, the damage was already done. Lesbians didn't trust her, and the second wave feminist movement had fractured into so many different offshoots based on the many marginalized people who felt that their interests were not represented by the main movement. So what we can see from all of this is that even as she participated in what would be considered more radical movements such as unions, Betty Friedan consistently sought the approval of normative politics. And despite much of her activism being fueled by a Jewish spirit of resistance, she upheld multiple systems of oppression to support an ideology that was ultimately self-serving and pandering to the dominant culture. For better or for worse, her Jewish background most definitely had an impact on her activism. And that is where we are going to end this episode for today. Thank you so much, Nadia, for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And I hope you all found this very informative.